Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCBA 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
You are at the interview part of the show. Today we have an award-winning author and a pretty amazing all-around good guy, Jeffrey Round. Thank you for being here.
Alan, thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
Wow. Now, we've got John Copenhaver on the line as well. He's kind of assisting me here with the we're doing a tag team on Jeffrey.
Hi, Al. Hi, Jeff.
So, now, Jeffrey, this is the first time you've been on the show, so let's talk about you. Where did it all start for you, and how did you get into writing?
Wow. You want to go right back to the roots. Okay. when I was four, before I learned my alphabet, I thought, I am a writer. As a kid, I thought, I'm a writer. There's never been a time when I didn't think I was a writer. So when I grew up to become a writer, it was not really a big surprise for me. It was for a lot of other people who just thought, oh, this kid's just a dreamer, like my parents. But you know, I turned out okay, and they think it's fine that I've become a writer. A little bit later, we lived in the city of Windsor across the river from Detroit, Michigan, and there was a lot of American influence on the television and certainly in bookstores. That's when I latched onto the Hardy Boys at the age of 10, and I remember distinctly I would get my allowance once a month. And it wasn't very much back then. It was probably less than $2. And I would go right off to the local bookshop and buy the latest installation of the Hardy Boys. They weren't new at that time, of course, but I would buy the next in the series. I think they were maybe 54 or 56 by that at that point. And I did eventually get, I think, all of them up to the age I was when they were published. And I would bring them home, and I would lie on my bunk bed turning the pages very slowly, and I would have on one side, in one hand I would have the book, and on the other hand I would have a bag of Cheeto-Lay corn chips. And my challenge was to make the corn chips last to the end of the book. And I would not get up from that bunk bed until I had finished The Adventures of Frank and Joe Hardy. So that's that was phase two, I guess, of my writing education.
I would think, being in Windsor, hearing the gunfire from Detroit, that's all you'd need.
It was inspirational. In fact, this was a little bit younger. I would plant my elbows on my bedroom windowsill, and I would look out across the river, and I was facing Detroit, and I could hear the gunshots, and I could actually see the smoke rising, and I just thought this was some special kind of television that someone had devised, because I didn't know any better.
Yeah. Well, it is quite amazing the difference in violence, like gun violence, between the U.S. and Canada. It's so extreme. It's almost unbelievable, I think, with a lot of Americans when you talk to them, especially further south you go as compared to closer to the border. But when you go further south, they're sort of surprised. They almost don't believe it.
Sorry, who doesn't believe it? The Americans or
the
Canadians?
No, the Americans almost don't believe that there's not the same sort of gun violence going on in Canada.
Well, they should come up for a visit and relax a bit.
Yeah, exactly.
That would be nice.
It is, not to make light of it, it is a problem. You may have heard about our big shooting in Nova Scotia a couple of weeks ago, and they've tracked a number of the guns back to the U.S. illegally, because those guns are not available in Canada, but they can be brought across the border. They can be sneaked across the border, and that does happen, unfortunately. But I never, growing up here, I never really understood the tendency to need to argue with guns. I just thought you there are better ways of doing it. So when I hear about the violence south of the border, I'm quite shocked to hear it too.
I grew up in southwestern Virginia in Appalachia, and I still don't understand the need for it. So I'm not. It's like I don't know. It's definitely a cultural mindset. It's not everywhere. It's interesting.
It is interesting, and I also remember as a kid watching cowboy movies, basically, and thinking, why do they need all these guns? And so, you know, it's a mindset.
Yeah.
It really is.
Yeah.
Oh, totally. It's part of the culture. So when was the first time you had a book published? Like, when did that start?
That was 1997. My first book came out from England. I had written a book called A Cage of Bones, which is not a mystery, even though it sounds like one. I had tried to shop it around in Canada quite a few times to a number of publishers and kept getting turned down. And finally someone said to me, well, did you try anywhere outside the country? And I said, well, no, I'm a Canadian. Shouldn't I be published here first? And that was when the light went on. I thought, okay, I'll send a trial letter to an American publisher, and I'll send a trial letter to a British publisher. So I sent both letters. And within a month, I got requests from both of them to submit the manuscript. And both of them eventually said, yes, we would like to accept your manuscript. So I actually had to choose. But the publisher in England was better known and had better distribution around the world. So I went with that press. And also part of the novel takes place in Britain, so it made sense that somebody outside Canada would actually want it. But it never occurred to me at the time, because, you know, in the States there are books, you know, published about other countries. In Canada there were books published about other countries, but I never made the connection that you might want to go to the source when you're a first-time author, because that is the breakthrough. That's the hardest one. That I experienced, and certainly many other writers have said, that was the hardest book to get out. Once you do, the gate is open, but you still have to know that it's only open a little bit. And unless you're making a lot of money for somebody, you still have to keep knocking and pushing and pushing your credentials, basically, to say, hey, I've got a second book and a third one, and they're both, you know, as good as or better than the first.
Yeah, it's a tough one. Now, what do you primarily write? Is it always kind of a crime fiction or a mystery?
No, and again, it was trial and error. My first book was literary fiction. When people said, what is it? I would say it's a cross between Sylvia Plath and Marcel Proust, and they would kind of, you know, shrug their shoulders and cross their eyes and go, huh? But fortunately for me, it was eventually published. It did very, very well around the world. My second book to be written was not to be published, but to be written, was another piece of literary fiction. It was about the Bosnian War in the 1990s, mm-hmm. and particularly in Sarajevo. Very heavy-duty stuff. And it was about a war journalist who goes from Canada to Sarajevo, basically because she can't stand the wars in her family, so she finds it easier to, you know, accept life during wartime in another country. That, again, was another fairly hefty work, and people were just not ready for it at the time. So my third book was actually my first mystery. It's called The P-Town Murders. And it came about in a moment of despair when I couldn't sell the second book. I took a trip with my partner at the time, and we went to Provincetown. And a lot of very strange things happened while we were there, and I met a lot of unusual people. Well, if you know Provincetown, I mean, you know, it is a place of eccentrics. So that's not really that unusual. But I remember thinking to myself, wow, I feel like I'm living in a murder mystery. And I thought all that's lacking is the body. Fortunately, there was no body. I had to invent one. But what really convinced me to sit down and write this when I got home, there were two things, actually. One was an incident when I was in the jacuzzi in the condo where I was staying, and I looked out across the way, and there were a pair of binoculars trained on me. I was sitting in the jacuzzi. I thought, okay, I feel I'm being spied on. This story clicked. This story clicked in my head. I say, I flashed the guy who was watching me with the binoculars, and I got a flash of my own back, and the flash was the murder mystery that came through. So I went home to write it. But what really triggered it when I got home? I had been staying as the guest of a fairly wealthy man who owned this building in Provincetown. All I knew was I'd never met him. I was hooked up with the place through a friend of a friend. And all I knew was his last name was Bradford. And when I got home, I realized there are two streets in Provincetown, two main streets. One is Bradford Street, the other is Commercial Street. And I phoned my friend, and I said to her, I said, Janice, does your boss, who was the owner of the house, does your boss have anything to do with Bradford Street in Provincetown? She said, yes, he was one of the people who came over on the Mayflower. And I thought, oh, I feel like I've just kind of mainlined something here. And sure enough, that book sold. I sat down and wrote it in 2 months, and that book sold in 2 weeks. Whereas the other books had taken me years to sell. And I thought, okay, I think I'm on to something here. It is a comic mystery. I should make that clear. I still wasn't taking mysteries seriously at that point. But from that one, I went to another and another and another. And very soon there were actually four of the Bradford. I took his name, the Bradford Fairfax Mysteries, all comedic, all of which take place on in LGBTQ resorts, the Provincetown, the P-Town Murders, Death in Key West, Vanished in Vallarta, and then Bon Ton Roulet was the latest one in New Orleans. So that was the impetus. And then I had an editor who turned to me one day and said, when are you ever going to take mysteries seriously? And I just thought, oh, that's a challenge. Maybe I should do that. And from that actually came the series, the Dan Sharp PI series, that of which Lionshead Revisited is the sixth and probably last, sorry, the seventh and last title.
Hmm. So where did you get your inspiration for that series, the Dan Sharp mysteries?
I would say, Alan, it's it's where I get all my inspirations from traveling. I'm almost an obsessive traveler. I like to meet people. I am very fond of driving, but I also love traveling by train. And when I'm in a train, I can just kind of gaze out the window and see the landscape passing by, and it's like I go into like a trance, and I start seeing scenes and characters and hearing dialogue, and it springs to life for me. So really, through travel, I would say more than any other source.
Hmm. I guess the current conditions have dampened that some, hey?
Well, I've been spending a lot of time on Google Maps, I have to tell you.
It's kind of interesting, but the characters you use in the book, how do you develop them? How does if you don't take them from people you know, Where does that come from? So especially in a series of books, if you have a returning character, how do you put together how they're going to develop?
I have to say it's like an impulse. It's an intuition, and I'm sure both of you can attest to this. You feel something mm-hmm. growing inside you, and you think, okay, that's a reflection of me, but it's not really me, especially when you get to the dirty nitty gritty, particularly you, Alan, with the serial killer. You don't ever want to be those people, but on some level, you want to say that you can hear them, you can feel something coming from them. And really, that's it. So it's very much once I get the feeling, how does this character think and breathe, and you know, what does he or she like to eat, or how do they dress, or what does their hair look like? They start to come alive. And in the case with the Dan Sharp character, the first book is called Lake on the Mountain, the first of the seven. Lake on the Mountain is a very interesting place on Lake Ontario. It's about 100 meters, I think, above sea level or water level. Yet there's a lake up there with no obvious incoming sources, and nobody can figure out. Well, they eventually have formed hypotheses, but they couldn't figure out at the time where did the water come from. And 100 years ago, it was actually a bit of a waterfall. It was just blasting out. While meanwhile, there's all this water, you know, like 100 feet down below. And so, why would that water rise up there? Well, it doesn't. It came from someplace else. But when you go there, you drive up there and you get out, and it's flat, and there's this lake. It's not very big, and there are no motor boats allowed on it. You can have paddle boats and canoes and things like that, but that's all you're allowed. You get this really eerie feeling that something is not right. It's almost like something is disobeying the laws of physics, the laws of nature. And eventually you figure out it's because the water is there and it shouldn't be there. And you turn in one direction, you see way, way down on the other side, you see the Bay of Quinte. And then you turn back to the lake, you think, how does this stay up here? So the first time I visited there, it left me with this eerie feeling, and I didn't know what to do with it. But my writer self said, this is something to, you know, put in a notebook, save for a rainy day. It wasn't until about a year later that I actually came across the story that I would write that took place up there, and the character Dan Sharp, Dan is not me, and sorry, I'm taking a long way to get around to this, but that's the point I'm getting at. Dan is not me, and occasionally we will have discussions that actually turn into arguments in my head about why he would do such and such, or why he would say such and such. Because it would be very foreign to my way of thinking, but it's natural for him. So I had to find a space inside me to accommodate this very intriguing character. It's almost as if you have a friend at a distance and you know what they would say in such and such a circumstance, but they're not there at that particular moment, and you can carry on an internal dialogue with them all the same. So real people, you can do that with real people, but in my case, I can do it with characters as well. And I think that's a quality that, it's almost a schizophrenic quality that probably all writers will develop at some point in their careers.
Hmm. Yeah. Did you feel an attachment to your characters then?
Yes, very much. They were almost like friends that, as I said, friends at a distance. Dan, particularly his son, Kedrick, who contradicts him a lot, and the best friend, Donnie. So these were very real people for me for the entire time I was writing the series. And the last book, the last few books came out. They came out of sequence, so you actually have to, if you're going to read the series in order, you have to rejig them in the order. So Lionshead Revisited was the seventh and last book that I wrote, but it's actually sixth in the series. So you have to find a place to accommodate these people within you. And as I was writing the last book, which should have been the second last book, and it refused to come out when I wanted it to, I felt the characters were not going to be there afterwards. And in fact, Dan doesn't talk to me anymore. It's a bit of a lonely feeling. It's like I've lost a friend. So he's not there. You know, the characters do take on flesh and blood proportions, but only in my mind. So obviously they're not physical people. And to a degree, they do reflect people I know. Dan, in fact, has my, I lost a younger brother a couple of years ago, and Dan was very much his sense of humor. He's very biting, very sarcastic. So there is a sense that there are real people that have the qualities that these characters embody, but you know, ultimately there are still characters in a book.
Yeah, you mentioned on your website that the Lionshead Revisited was, you're kind of moving to include more female characters. I was really curious about that.
That's not the first time. The book on Sarajevo was mostly female characters. It was about three sisters and the mother. In this case, I just got tired of the men. And I think Dan did too. He just got tired of all these men complaining about men things. And so he was thrilled when this modern family of two women and a man, so there's the mother of the child who is missing. Her child is kidnapped. But there's also her partner, who's a woman, and then the biological father. So they form this threesome, not sexually, but as a modern day family. They all live together and they raise this child together who goes missing. And so Dan is really intrigued when there's kind of a new, a new turnaround on the classic mystery case. And he's thinking, okay, now I've got something I can actually be interested in because I'm really, really, fed up with all the men and their nonsense. So that's where that came from. Also the Me Too movement, I just thought, okay, here are voices that are finally being heard. So let's see how these will fit into Dan Sharp's world. And he was more than happy to accommodate them.
Hmm. You know, I was talking with John a little bit before the interview. And, in my world, working in the true crime world, it's being gay is not actually a positive thing. It's still quite, conservative. You're dealing with cops, and I deal with a lot of people in that business, and they're very, they'll tell me jokes about gay people, right? So it's kind of, it's not really, they don't really associate, it's just not real, a friendly atmosphere, I don't think, up till now still. How do you find the publishing world as far as with gay stories and gay characters like Dan that are, in the mysteries and detectives and people like that. Did you find it quite open to it, or is it a struggle with publishers too?
Well, let me step back here a minute. My brother who's gone now, Mark, he was a cop, and he was married to a cop, a woman, a female cop. And my other brother, my other younger brother, it was a Marines fisheries officer. And my father was a hunter. So, you know, we would all get together at Christmas, and they would talk about their guns, and I'd sit there and think about John Donne and, you know, Marcel Proust, and I'd think, how did I get into this family? But obviously something wore off on me that I realized I had to make this story in a way that was accessible to many, many people. As far as the publishing aspect goes, I have been fortunate in having met publishers who turned out to be gay. I didn't necessarily know that they were when I met them, but there was a sympathy there. And when I would describe the material, they would be show their interest in what I was doing. Of course, publishers still want to make that bottom line of sales and the dollar figures coming in. So they're not going to publish a book because they like you. They're going to publish a book because they think that they can sell the book and make some money doing so. As far as is it easier these days, I don't think it's a lot easier. There are more gay-themed publishers, but in terms of getting into the larger publishers, I don't think it's easier. I do see some gay writers, gay and lesbian writers getting in, but these seem to be still the exception to the rule. And when we look at books like Call Me By Your Name by Andre Ackerman, these are books that have a critical success as well as a commercial success, but then we find out that the author is actually not gay. So I don't know how that feeds into the sensibility of the book. I did read the book and watch the movie. I don't like to sit and think about the themes of the book as straight as opposed to gay when I'm writing it. I like to look at it later after the book's finished and see what's actually there. And it is, in many cases, a question of reaching across to the audience that is outside the realm of comfort of sometimes reading these books. I do get letters, fan letters, and sometimes the opposite, from people who have read them and want to reach out and tell me what they think of the books. And the letters do go across the spectrum of sexuality. But in terms of ease of access to publishers, I would say no, I don't think it's really that easy. Compared to any time in the past, I don't think it's easier than what it has been.
Yeah, one of the questions you talked about it.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information, information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
A little bit was sort of this idea of what your who your audience is and how that kind of plays into whether publishers see your book as marketable or, you know, I know they're worried whenever they feel like it's a niche audience because there's sort of a mind frame, I think, often that only gay people read about gay people or that could be any other sort of other individual. And I don't know, do you feel like that's playing any role in it? And is there, what are your feelings about that? What's your sense of it?
The one thing I can tell you is that the reviews I get are dominated by gay media sources, gay papers. And that skews who the book is seen by. But there is crossover. I definitely know that. The one thing that gives me a bit of hope these days is I don't know if anybody's been watching the Netflix limited series, and I am seeing that there is an attempt there, at least in my mind, it seems to be an attempt to normalize diversity rather than to make it an oddity or to leave it as an oddity as it has been in the past in mainstream media. So I think the crossover is happening in ways we may not be entirely aware of at the time, but I still think it's harder for gay writers writing about gay themes to get their books published in mainstream presses. I think that's a given.
Yeah.
When you do your books, is there is there something that you want people to get out of your books after they read it? Do you have some sort of a framework that you work with to create these mystery stories?
I would think if I have a message, and I don't really want to be, you know, listed as a message writer, but if I have a message, it's basically, how do you treat other human beings? How do you relate to other human beings? Because that's the story. It's very much about the relationships in the book. Dan, his son, the woman who gave birth to the son, his best friend, the people he works with, the clients he works with. It's really about what kind of relationship you form with people and how you choose to proceed to be the best person you can, or conversely, how you know, if you're a not a good guy in the series, how you decide to be not a good person and what that means overall. So it's that background, the human being, the human aspect of is the background of it. And I hope people walk away with that. I also hope they walk away thinking, wow, that was really clever. He fooled me. That is kind of the point of a mystery, is you don't want people to guess, but you want to place it under their nose at the same time. And then at the last minute say, you missed that, didn't you? And try not to feel too smug about it.
So where do you see yourself going now? Like what do you want to venture out in different areas of writing? Do you want to stick to mystery? You've done some standalone books as well. Where do you see your future?
I have always written across the spectrum of writing. I mean, I've written plays, I've written screenplays. Drama, I think, is my forte at the heart of whatever I write, which is why I try to put so much of the human element into the mystery. I am making a conscious attempt at this point to wipe the slate clean and start with something quite fresh. I don't think there will be another Dan Sharp book. There certainly won't be another book about Sarajevo in the near future. What I'm working on now is potentially a series that is a bit more in the thriller genre, if we can call it that, and it relates to CSIS, which is the Canadian Security Intelligence Service in Canada, which would be a little bit like CIA, but not quite so extreme. Perhaps a little bit more like MI6 in Britain. But again, it's going to relate to the relationships and the personalities within the story. That's really what is at the heart of any book that I write, is who are these people, what are they about, why do they do the things they do, and where do they end up because of it? And that's really what I try to examine in all of my writing.
What are your biggest influences on these stories?
The current one that I'm writing, the CSIS series, probably the biggest influence would be John le Carré. He's a writer that I have a great respect for. And when I'm feeling kind of, you know, a little bit disillusioned with the world, I go into his world of disillusionment and I see what's there and I see how I can rise above it personally, but also use his vision, his wisdom, and try to make a Canadian version of that, but one which will read, you know, internationally, because John le Carré is not just a British writer. He's not just writing about spies. He's writing about human beings and how they find their place in the world. And I think that's what writers do.
Mm-hmm. So when you write about this, like you're writing about CSIS and stuff, and the world right now is, especially in the States, is really, I don't know if you want to say paranoid, or there's a lot of conspiracy, and it kind of bubbles over in Canada. Do you find that... in writing this book, you include that kind of, you know, that conspiracy and paranoid and deep state sort of view?
To a degree. I mean, I'm not writing about conspiracy theory, and I like all of my books to reflect reality, but perhaps a heightened reality. In researching the current series, I was very interested to find how before CSIS began, which I believe was in 1984, formally, the CIA did a lot of things in Canada with our permission. They were secret things. They were hidden things. But they did experiments. They were doing work to counteract things during the Cold War. What people sometimes forget, because we tend to look at the world from east to west, but if you look at it from north to south and back again, Canada is situated directly between the U.S. and Russia. So, you know, there's some kind of subliminal worry there, implicit in the fact that if there is ever a war between, well, then it was the USSR, but between Russia and the U.S., there could be a lot of literal fallout in this country. So there is that sense of, you know, we are caught between extreme warring factions, and we always have to be careful. But we tend not to be a paranoid society in Canada. We tend to be a little bit naive, in my point of view. And that is one of the secondary themes in the book, is how naive Canada is and how long it can afford to go on being naive in the face of you know, what's happening in the world today.
Yeah, I always find that when I'm on stateside, I think that it's over-policed and over-dramatized. And when I'm in Canada, I feel it's under-policed. And like you say, naive. It's kind of a... The two countries have really gone different directions since mm-hmm. the 50s and 60s. It's kind of, It's kind of unusual feeling going back and forth. So out of your books, what was your favorite one to write?
You know, I'll give the standard writer answer. Each one was the favorite one at the time I was writing it. And that's true. If I look back, and Alan, I think you've had 15, 16 books. How many have you had?
Yeah, I think there's 16 now published.
Okay. So I'm at 15. 15 published, not 15 written. I've got a couple sitting in a drawer, literary novels that I can't sell. I can't sell them yet. I find usually there's a 3 or 4 year gap before somebody says, "Oh, that's very today." And I think, no, that was very 5 years ago when I was writing it. But now you're getting it. The one that if I reread, and I very seldom reread my books, the Dan Sharp series was up for a revision of a proofreading revision because they're going into mass market paperback. So I had to go through them and read and find out all the spelling mistakes and the grammatical errors and things. But I wasn't allowed to change the actual text unless it was an error. But my project for about 6 months was to go back and read all the books. And I hadn't read any of them since they were published because I don't enjoy going back to them. I see all the mistakes that I think I've made that most people don't see. But in this case, the book of all the Dan Sharp books that I enjoyed most is the most recent one, Lionshead Revisited. It seems to me it's the one where I pulled everything together in the way that I wanted to and did not disappoint myself at all. So I'm a very harsh parent. I'm very strict. So it's just easier to turn a blind eye to what, you know, my wanton children are doing out in the world and rather than go after them and say, "You forgot the semicolon and you didn't do this and you forgot to ask that question." And it really gets under my skin. So I literally don't read them until I have to read them. So in this case, that was the impetus for it.
Yeah, I'm like that too. I never go back. But, you know, with each book that I have done, there's always something that changes after I've written the book. So when I go on to the next book, it will be different because of that book. Do you know? I'm not sure if that affects you the same way in these series.
It's sort of a cumulative effect of what you're dealing with. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, because once I go through something, like, you know, when I was doing the Russell Williams case, you're doing it and you're meeting a lot of people. And once you get finished it, you just learn a whole new aspect of how people treat each other, how they live their lives. And a lot of it, sometimes it surprises you, right? So I'm kind of old. But you take it in because it's true. And then you come on to do your next project, and I'm now different after being through that project.
I'm not at all surprised to hear you say that, especially given the nature of the material you're dealing with, because you cannot take it lightly. With fiction, it's a little bit different, but you do get to know the characters as people, as I mentioned earlier. And one of the things that surprised me in this last book, which is why I think it wouldn't come out chronologically, as I mentioned, it should have been the sixth book, and it came out as the final book. I had to dig deeper into Dan's character to actually help him solve the mystery in this book, because it's called Lionshead Revisited. Lionshead is where the kidnapping in the book takes place. But it's also where Dan had some of his most profound memories of his father and his mother, both of whom are long since dead when the current story starts. But he had to dig deep. And in doing so, I was able to help him see the mystery and the kidnapping in a different light find a way for him to solve the kidnapping that was relevant to him. And it brought out great depths in his character. And so in that sense, all the seven books were cumulative as I got to know Dan and basically put his life on paper more than any other character I've ever done.
See, I think that's really interesting because you describe Dan as a like a living person. You have to help him and you dig deeper and stuff. See, that's what I find fascinating, because on my side, it's that they are living people, and I really don't try to help them. So, you know, they've already done what they do, and it's kind of going with the effects. So I find that interesting. So how does that process? Like, that's what I'm trying to understand. It's the process of you taking this character that is not real, but you have to make them real in order to, you know, do this series of books and deal with all these different events or happenings. And so can you explain that process a little bit, or
is it well hard? To do that, I'm going to take you back to my 10-year-old self reading Frank and Joe Hardy in my bunk bed with the Frito-Lay's corn chips. I didn't realize that they were not real people. Okay, 10 years. I mean, maybe I should have thought into it a little bit more, but in my head, they were real people. And I remember, because keep in mind, we lived across from Detroit, Michigan, and I believe the Hardys lived somewhere in Bay City, Michigan. So I came down to breakfast one day, and after I'd been reading the book, and I asked my mother where the Hardy boys lived. And she looked at me and she said, "They're not real. You realize that, don't you?" And I was heartbroken. I stuttered and I said, but they could be, couldn't they? Because I was unwilling to give up that reality that they actually existed and had solved, you know, all 54 murders by the age of 17 or crimes by the age of 17, whatever it was, with the help of, you know, Fenton, their father. For me, characters, if I'm deeply invested in them, on some level, they have to be real. And for Dan, he and I struggle because we are definitely not the same person. And he would say things and do things. I think, I don't agree with that. But psychologically, it wouldn't make any sense for me to force my actions and my thoughts on him. Because then I would walk away thinking, I've just falsified a character, or I've falsified a person. It's like lying about somebody. And I would not be able to believe in him. So I had to give him full rein to do and think what he would do as a person. So he had become so fully dimensional in my head that eventually I would know, you know, what he would have for lunch, what he would wear, what he would not wear, what he might, you know, what toothpaste he would buy, or you know, whether he would have his hair cut short or long. And these would ultimately have very, very little to do with my personal predilections. So he just took on that dimension of a reality that I think seven books allows you to do that. Whereas one book, you might not be able to explore all of his facets.
Yeah. It's tough. Plus I have to, personally, I have to go around and see as many people as I can and talk to them, people that knew whoever you're doing the book about. So in the true crime, you talk to parents and families, friends and all that, and that sort of helps give a 360, you know, of that person. It's not just two-dimensional. So that's what I was, because you don't have that in your character.
No, but I have it in the secondary characters who all have opinions about him. So I do get feedback from other people, as it were, other characters, obviously. And that helps me fully flesh things out to know the person I'm dealing with. And of course, nobody is just one thing. I mean, we all change, you know, sometimes on a daily basis, sometimes on an hourly basis. So you have to be aware of that too. So I was aware of inconsistencies in his character that would not be outside the scope of his personality ultimately. But when I would argue with him, what I was getting at was, why am I not, I, the author, why am I not comfortable with the choices that are being made for this character? Because something is standing out as, no, he would, somebody like this, the person I'm describing, would not do these things. And it was usually the would nots as opposed to the woulds. Sometimes that little discussion, inner discussion, would lead me to something like, oh, but he might do this instead. And occasionally that gave me an avenue, a plot avenue, that was quite rewarding to follow along with.
Do you ever feel that that you have, like, uncovered something that you were unaware of about the character as you're writing or through editing? In other words, it doesn't feel predetermined. It feels like you kind of discovered it, you know, embedded in your writing. It was like through writing, it was discovery, I guess. Has that happened to you?
John, I have to say that's a constant with me. I try very hard not to edit my thoughts while I'm writing, because I find that's a deterrent to actually getting things mm-hmm. on page. So sometimes I look back and I think, wow, that's a lot of garbage on that page, but I'll look for the one sentence or the one thought or even the one word that goes, that's what I wanted. That's why I had to write that entire page, that entire passage. That's where I was going. And then I just get rid of it and I hone in on that particular aspect. And for me, writing is always following someone else's carrot. I'm just very grateful there are a lot of carrots out there being waved in front of me to follow, because otherwise I don't know if I would do it.
No, it's interesting. I find that fascinating. So now, do you like to interact with your readers as well? Do you have like a big social media profile and all that you take as you know, quotes or questions from people?
I'm definitely very happy to do it. I don't know if my media profile is that big. I'm on Facebook. I do a bit of Twitter. So I don't spend a lot of time online, but as soon as I get a question, as soon as I get some interest, I am very happy to respond to it. One of the ways we were promoting the current book, Lionshead Revisited, was I put pictorials. As I mentioned, I'm a traveler and I'm also a photographer. So I take pictures of wherever I go, and some of those end up as being scenes from the books. And so I've always got these photographic guides. So what I did was I went through them, culled them down to just a handful of pictures, and wrote essays on each of the seven books, what had inspired them, some of the physical places that I had been. After I had done that, I realized I had gotten so many questions on Facebook, I went ahead and took out the best of the questions and actually sat down and answered directly all of those questions. There were about 10, and made an entire other essay on just the questions that had come out of readers' imaginations, and that inspired me too. So it's something I do like to do, but I'm not, as I said, I'm not really someone who sits online all day and waits for I don't wait for people to ask me questions.
That was better that way.
I'd much rather wait for them to offer me to take me out for a drink.
Yeah, it's better that way. No, do you? Well, that's funny, because when you travel, for me, I write when I travel. I can't write a lot of narrative at home. Do you find that as well, or do you, it doesn't matter to you?
One of the best scenes I wrote, again, in the current book, I was on an airplane. I think I was flying to New Orleans, and I realized that I had a book coming, a scene coming up in the book, the current book, the one that's just out. that takes place while somebody's in an airplane looking down at the ground and imagining what's going on there. I thought, hey, I'm in an airplane. Why don't I look out the window and imagine what's going on there? And it was actually one of the most vivid scenes I've ever written. It, in the book, it takes place in a helicopter. Dan has found a clue to the kidnapping in at Lion's Head, which is a geographical location 4 hours north of Toronto. He comes back with the clue. The police say, hey, we need to get you back there, but we can't spend all the time driving. We're going to take you in the helicopter. So he's up in the helicopter. He's reimagining the scenes from his childhood as they're passing below him, and he's seeing what's going on there. So, yes, I love to write while I'm traveling. Trains are my favorite, but I even write in subways sometimes when, you know, I'm trying to avoid being jostled and pushed and shoved and, you know, trying to get away from those knapsacks that everybody's wearing these days. Or not these days, currently. Nobody's on the subway, I don't think.
Pretty quiet now. No, yeah, I'm that way too. I love traveling and writing, so it works. Wow. So let's give out your website. So if people want to come and check out your books and find out more about you, where is it that they go?
So worldwideweb.jeffreyround, that's JeffReyRound, round like a circle, but spell my first name correctly. Everybody wants to turn it into three syllables. It's not Jeffery, it's JeffreyRound.com. And please, you can send me a question. There's a link at the bottom that will send you to another link that will allow you to ask questions.
Goes through the CIA first.
I think it does.
Yeah, no doubt.
GoDaddy is another word for CIA.
That's it.
Oh, I hope I won't get in trouble for that.
No, you will. Well, great. This has been a incredible interview. We've enjoyed having you on, and hopefully we'll get you back again sometime, and we will have your website linked up to ours as well as your newest book. Great. Well, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us about writing.
And guys, thanks. It's been great to meet you virtually. I hope Alan and John, we get to do it in person one day, and you know, we'll exchange more stories. It's been great. Thank you.
Sounds great.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about...
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.